Welcome to Season 4, Episode 15 of the Practical 365 Podcast with me, Steve Goodman, and Paul Robichaud. Hi, Paul. How are you?
Hi, Steve. I'm doing better than Boeing. How are you?
I am doing pretty well, actually. I am not at the MVP Summit this week, but I hear you are going to be on your way, even though once you get there, you can't say anything.
I am. I wasn't able to be there for opening day right at the opening bell, but I'll be there early tomorrow, and I'm looking forward to it. It's always a great opportunity to get together with the product teams. A lot of Copilot content. I heard there might be a session or two about Mesh, which I personally will not be attending.
Oh, Mesh.
There's some good stuff there.
I've virtually signed up for a couple of the Mesh ones, but I'm interested in the development side of it in a way, but I can't say anything about it. But I notice it has been appearing as immersive spaces in many clients over the last month, yet people are mostly talking about Copilot.
It is dominating the narrative, as the kids say these days.
And we're joined on the show this week by John Jarvis. So another podcast host and a Microsoft MVP. Hi, John.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Not bad at all. So we've met a few times in person. And you've been an MVP now for, is it a couple of years?
Just over a year. So first renewal coming up.
Oh, good luck. Good luck.
May the odds be ever in your favor.
Scary times.
So we're going to talk about Intune in a bit, you can certainly join in because it'd be lovely to hear your experience across the board, because you aren't just an Intune or device management person, are you?
No, I tend to... When I'm at work, I normally say I do most things within the Microsoft 365 space that doesn't include Teams. Generally, but everything else, I can dip my toes in.
Yeah. So security and compliance.
Yeah, security compliance, Defender purview. Defender's my joint first love alongside Team and alongside Intune. So yeah.
Yeah, and Copilot.
I haven't stopped talking about Copilot. I think we've done about 30 workshops since last June, July on Copilot. Ever since the days where we actually didn't know much about it, but we was doing workshops anyway, and figuring it out as we went because of lack of information, etc. But we're there now, and still doing them.
So yeah, I think we've got a Copilot to talk about on the show actually. But I have to mention, for those of you going to London next week, or to Paris, or even to Munich, we will be at the Experts Conference at the European Roadshow. It's going to be jam-packed with Active Directory Microsoft 365 training content from the experts themselves and myself. Paul, you're not going to be there, I don't think, are you?
I wasn't invited.
No, I kind of invited myself, to be fair, because
I was invited, to be fair.
Yeah. It is absolutely fantastic, though. It's actually quite good to bring that content to people in their home cities. And I hope to see some of you next week if you're joining. It might be a little bit too late to get tickets, but it's always worth a shot, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%.
Now
I'll be there, so I'll be seeing you guys.
Well, I will see you, John, next week. Last time I spoke, there was another Steve Goodman in the audience who was also like bold and about 40, which was good because I was talking about like disaster recovery and I had high availability right there in the room with me, in case I failed and I needed, a HAV motion starling to pop up on the other side. He didn't find it as funny as me, I must admit. Now, moving swiftly on. Copilot. Copilot. Do you like talking about Copilot and AI, Paul? Because it does seem to be the common topic of every show.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to talk about there. One of the things that we talked about in the pregame that we wanted to mention was Microsoft is sort of belatedly recognizing that maybe everybody doesn't want everything indexable and findable in Copilot. So they're going to give us some additional controls to restrict how SharePoint search and Copilot interact.
It's a double-edged sword because the usefulness is being able to have access to certain information or good curated information. And I think there'll be a tendency to do what people sometimes do when they're building Azure OpenAI type style RAG or retrieval augmented generation type apps, where they'll focus it on a HR site or some policies, and things become a little less useful. Mm-hmm. But I think the biggest challenge is people often don't know what they don't know. So they don't actually know whether they've got a big problem or a small problem to deal with. Copilot is, the one thing I found though is it's, and I say this coming from being an Exchange admin. So if you've done an Exchange upgrade or moved somebody to Exchange Online, then it's not the sort of walk around the office and get high fives kind of moment. I think when Michael Van Horenbeek moved people to Exchange 2013, it was quite the opposite, to be fair, because it was before Service Pack 1 on a bunch of patches. Your task is not to make anybody notice this. There used to be a Microsoft video showing a move to the cloud that nobody knew you'd done anything, which isn't that fun. Well, it's fun to get it right and see that everything's working smoothly. But Copilot certainly, with good adoption advice, it's really well received by people because they're excited about the prospect of being able to do something. And then they don't really know what it is they're going to achieve with it. And then through business change and adoption, all that sort of stuff, then people walk out of sessions like actually feeling like they're really going to save time. Or as I did on site at a customer that I've been working as part of a team doing that for, people are like, wow, this is literally like just saved me 30 minutes. This is absolutely amazing. And that sort of reaction from technology, especially if you've used Copilot yourself and then stop using it for a bit because it has, initial excitement that then drops after a peak, then it's kind of good news, and makes it pretty worthwhile. So anything that gets over the hurdle of can we use it or not? What do we need to restrict things to? If we restrict people's access to all of Microsoft 365 data in SharePoint, then it'll be, it won't be useful at all. So the restricted SharePoint search, so I've already heard it being brought up by customers and Microsoft when talking about how to approach this. But I believe it's not available right now. It's going to be
be rolling out.
I think it's going to be rolling out April.
It's only going to be you're only going to be able to restrict certain site libraries, right? By a site library by site library basis. So
yes. So that if you for example run a report with SharePoint Advanced Management as a trial or something else, and you find a lot of problems, then this could be the point where you do this. But I don't think there's going to be a point where people don't just do some sort of one-time thing and then forget about managing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the only kind of real use cases that I can see of it is really, really sensitive data. Like, we're talking like government, right. There's really like highly sensitive data, maybe images and stuff like that. There's certain information that shouldn't be put on. But for most use cases, we're talking about financial data, if you're talking to lawyers and law firms and data that's not really too secret and probably won't get shared anyway, even if you did search for it. So,
A common thread with most customers seems to be terms and conditions that people sign up to as they get their Copilot license, or NDAs and so on, and the type of people that go onto these pilots for several months before they roll out will generally be cherry-picked anyway from the user community. There won't be people they're expecting, be nominated by their manager and so on. So it's about that, people are going to put the blocks on this of risk and compliance. So whilst Copilot probably won't even answer from the most sensitive data if it was overshared, that doesn't stop the fact that now somebody in another team like risk and compliance know that this thing that could actually have been searched and is easier to find and retrieve using Microsoft 365 search is not even is theoretically retrievable, but won't be retrieved and displayed because of the safety controls. That's a big loop of stuff all mashed together, but it means it's like one of those things where it's hard to explain. They won't necessarily understand it. Microsoft don't necessarily document how like a business ethics filter, it's described a few podcasts ago by Microsoft, that's inside Copilot works exactly, or how you could tune it. So that information, they're going to put a block on it.
Copilot doesn't actually become the problem then. The problem is actually the enterprise search and the semantic indexing in the background. Copilot is like the innocent party that gets...
Right. It's the fear. It's like a FUD, the fear that someone will ask it something and it will go over the top on retrieving things. But it doesn't actually work that way. If you ask it to find information, like somebody sent me something that goes, if I ask it to find passwords, it found passwords. And then I went on to Microsoft 365 search and searched for the same thing and the same file came up. So, but what's the difference? It won't try and retrieve salary data and all that sort of stuff because even if it could, it'll get blocked. But it's not helped by the idea that it might. The semantic index and the connectedness of search terms.
There's another piece that we have to look forward to also, which is when, hypothetically, someone produces a document or they produce a work product that should have included something that was improperly restricted by search. In other words, maybe I'm writing a manual for my electric vehicle, and there should be a section in it that says, don't turn on full self-driving, or you might accidentally run over a pedestrian. And that document does not appear, so it does not get included. And then I'm back to where Air Canada was when they turned an unmoderated chatbot loose on their customers.
It would be a completely wrong assumption, I think, to start creating something with nothing and expect it to generate. You've got to have the context to give it to make it focus and be useful. Mm-hmm. And tell it what, you are a technical author that writes accurate guides on airplane mechanics or engineering, create a draft of this thing and then give it the thing. I think that'll give you that's the best way to approach it rather than if you expect to just find and collate all the things you've got access to.
It won't find and collate, but the problem with security trimming has always been you don't know when there are potentially useful or potentially important results that you're not seeing because they're security trimmed. And this just, when you couple this with the irrational confidence or misplaced confidence that people sometimes put in LLM-generated results, I think we're probably going to see some, give it 12 months or so, and I think we'll probably see some egregious examples of it.
I mean, it would always go back to like Copilot should only be doing 70% of the work, and you should be doing the rest 30% to make sure everything is in place. And that's going to be the Microsoft tagline for that one anyway.
A good way to think of it is it's like having an employee. They're really great at searching through and digging through all the information, but they've just started. You've given them a task. They're not necessarily smart per se, but they're great at pulling stuff together. You would not then forward that on without thoroughly checking it through. It's a different way of working, like instead of writing an article or a guide or something like that, and then proofreading it afterwards. You start by proofreading in a way, that copy, and then changing it and bolding it. It's a copilot. It's not an autopilot. All these sort of things that people have to be explained when they start using it. Otherwise, some people genuinely do think that this is going to do magic for them. Like, can I ask it to build me an application? Can I ask it to do this? Because of the intermixing of different copilots, people often don't know what it can do for them.
Yeah, I mean, I had a customer the other day who asked me, we've got all these reports coming through. I'll try to be a bit ambiguous and stuff, but we get all these reports coming through and we want them to go over to this other report, all filter in. We want to make sure. I was like, no, it's not going to work like that. First of all, every time you ask it to do something, it's a little different every single time. So it's not Copilot what you want. It's not Copilot for Microsoft 365 that you want. It could be Copilot Studio, etc., to build it out. But I think a lot of people getting confused with actual Copilot for Microsoft 365 can actually do, and try to, you know, rein in that magic that they think is actually is going to do. It does come. But that's what adoption is about. And I think I've said before, I said to a lot of customers, like, it's not a Copilot for Microsoft 365 is not, it's the most technical product. That's not actually for technical people. It's a product for everybody. And when you go to that, I think you mentioned it about adoption and the uptake of it. It really isn't for IT people, in my opinion. So I've had customers that have gone, okay, we're going to pilot it for 30 people. I was like, who's the 30 people going to be? Well, we're going to have 25 people from IT in it. I was like, no. Right. Make sure it's like, you know, one or two people from different organizations, teams from around the organization, and build a champions network up. Like, make sure that you have regular check-ins consistently, because otherwise people are going to go, oh, shiny new products, that looks cool, and then stop using it. Because
yeah.
They don't know how. But I've been talking about this so much.
We should probably move on, because there'll always be another episode where we'll be talking about something AI related.
This is true.
Yes.
True.
One thing that I suppose it's less about the thing, but it's more about the implication in a way. So voicemail, Paul, this has been a subject that, for better or for worse, you've been known for like unified messaging on the master's program way back when.
Yes,
you know, I certainly won't brand you as the voicemail person. Much Thanks like when that. Tony Redmond wanted to call me PS Steve. it's a topic you've got a lot of experience in, and I used to like the idea of unified messaging way back when.
I loved the idea of unified messaging. And, you know, that's no secret. As you say, I've been tainted by association with it for a long time. And I like the way voicemail works in the service, right? It does sort of what you would expect if you get a voicemail. If someone, you know, tries to Teams call you and you don't answer, or you have your settings set appropriately, you get a voicemail.
Yeah.
That's table stakes, right? Everybody expects it to work that way. It's the way cell phones work and so on. But one of the things I always liked about unified messaging is it really did deliver what Microsoft was promising when they talked about better together between Link or OCS and Exchange. And there have been some features like that in the service. One of them was, if you set your out-of-office state in the calendar, then the system would automatically switch to using your out-of-office voicemail greeting. Which to me, man, that's great. It means I can record a greeting once. It says, hey, this is Paul. I'm out of the office. You know, please leave a message and I'll get to it when I get to it. But it may be a while if it's urgent, you know, message me or whatever it is. And then the system was smart enough to do that. To me, this sort of falls into the same bucket as the system and the person of OWA being smart enough to know that when I create a multi-day out-of-office event, I want my calendar blocked so that people can't schedule things on top of it. I may want to clear my calendar, right? And we already have those options built into the calendar client. So this past week, Microsoft announced that they were going to turn off the automatic out-of-office message integration. And I completely understand that, right? I mean, I spend more of my time than I would like to admit deciding which features I'm going to give up on because people are not using them in volume enough to justify the engineering investment. So I get that, right? That's part of something that every product manager and every product team has to do. But the two reasons they gave in the Message Center post were super interesting. One was that they want to do a better job of protecting customer data privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was they wanted it, it had high resource usage. And I thought, okay, I'm prepared to give them the data privacy because my guess is that's run by a centralized microservice that's running somewhere out of region. So if your mailbox is in Europe and your voicemail stuff is being touched by a process that's running somewhere that's not in Europe, potentially that might be a data sovereignty or data residency concern.
And that's so, that's a guess, right? That's not
Guess. Just right? Nobody's told me that, but given how much effort Microsoft has put into go local and stay local, Yeah, that seems reasonable. But the resource consumption, it's like, wow, you know, how much could this possibly be consuming if people are not using it heavily? If they are using it heavily, that would seem like it would argue in favor of fixing it. So it sounds like this feature has a high sort of idle footprint, and it doesn't have usage numbers to justify keeping it. So I'm a little sad that it's gone, but just the wording of the announcement I thought was unusual. Microsoft normally doesn't say, we're going to turn off this feature because it costs us too much money to keep it.
Does anyone like voicemail? You know, is it a Gen X thing?
Hmm.
It's
better than a missed call notification for most people. Although
I don't need
the missed call notification. The missed call notification at least tells you the important signal. Someone called, but you don't know why. Did they call because my car is on fire in the parking lot? Did they call because they wanted to fire me? You know, you don't have any context to tell you other than knowing the identity of the caller.
So, answer to your question, Steve, about voicemails. I don't think I've left a voicemail for someone in probably over a decade. I don't listen to voicemails either, and I just call the person back.
I mean, the only voicemails I've received over the last year were my local potential Labour candidates going on about our huskings, and the one that ran an AI company, weirdly, was the one that actually knocked on the door. but the rest were, you know, that's it. That's the, I don't need that. I thought I'd switched it off on my phone and somehow it magically got switched on. But I've switched it off in Teams myself because I'm never going to listen to them. Because the only people that leave voicemails are recruiters and salespeople. There's nothing I'm going to buy because I picked up my phone the other day. I always ignore unknown numbers. And I did answer it. And the weirdest thing was, I've been thinking about that particular vendor the day before. And I was like, oh, actually, yeah, I do need a meeting with you. So I eat my words a little bit. But generally, you know, I don't listen to voicemail either. But you know, Microsoft must have statistics that show what this balance is of people who get voicemails, can't be bothered to switch off the facility, and then never listen to them. And you must look at that and go, that is consuming a lot of resources in terms of, you know, storage, processing and transcription. And I bet it's quite inefficient these days compared to like Whisper or something like that as a way of transcribing.
So definitely the cloud has taught users that they don't have to care what the resource footprint of a service is because it's magic. It's in the cloud. Now, developers know better, or they should know better. Many of them don't. So, you know, I don't fault Microsoft for doing this. Features come, features go. Some of them arrive or depart faster than others, depending on how useful they are. So, you know, the world moves on.
Yep. And it's almost about that time that Google, I think Samsung, folks like that are coming out with AI-driven or generative AI-driven tools that answer your phone for you on the device and use local models or whatever to have a conversation with the caller and instead of having a voicemail, work out whether you actually want to speak to them in the first place. So I don't think that would be something that Teams would benefit from, you know, but the world does move on, doesn't it? So maybe...
Well, not the version of Teams that we use, but if you accept Microsoft, frontline users should have Teams and that, you know, Teams should be in every call center.
Oh, look, maybe a contact center solution. But, you know, do you want to speak to more robots?
I do not.
No.
Do not.
Intune, I think, is our next topic. And this is what Practical 365 writer and MVP and all around great guy, John Jarvis, is with us today. So, John, Intune may be one of your fortes then. From what you said earlier, people might call you a T-shaped person or maybe like a fork because you've got several specialities. I'll be careful not to I'll be careful how I say that, because that could certainly go down the wrong way. But you've written quite a popular article on the site, the critical need for integrating devices with Intune. And I think that's a controversial topic for some folk. But tell us, make the case for why we should.
The article done very well. I had quite a few shares from high people at Microsoft, so I was quite happy with that. But, the reason why I enjoyed working with Intune so much, and it could, you could look at other MDM providers, Workspace ONE and Jamf if you're using Mac, etc. It's just not only the management of device in terms of like sending down the applications and all of that other stuff, but it's just like the actual fundamental security of the device just upgrades massively as soon as you integrate it with Intune. So I think stuff we mentioned in the article, compliance policies that are integrated directly with devices that are in Intune, conditional access policies, the actual integration into Fendfare endpoint, and the built-in security baselines that you can put into there, all the session, all of the security policies you can put straight in. If you've got a good Intune, what's the word for it? If you've got a good Intune configuration in place, then your devices are fundamentally so much more secure than a legacy domain joined PC that's in on-premise Active Directory and, gaining dust in the technical sense.
One thing I've seen is Intune has come along a long way, over the years, which, like most Microsoft products, you'd expect it to do so. But certainly to the point where I would almost certainly prefer it to using Config Manager. I know that there's other, tools that are often quite straightforward or simple to use in the market that do stuff. But also things that were part of Active Directory that you would use a lot as part of group policies, for example, to run scripts against machines and so on. I just find they work better in Intune. And I've got more control over them. And the things that I found in the past were difficult, or you press a button to ask it to do something and it might feel like it's gone into a black hole, work pretty reliably as well, and they give you good information back. I like the new Laps integration as well. I think that works really, really well. So I'm not in disagreement with you, but I do get pushback both from endpoint experts, end user compute teams who might have existing devices that they don't really want to onboard to Intune because perhaps they've got an existing MDM that they were managing or not managing stuff with. For example, they've got a base image that's deployed out of the other product, and then they've been installing stuff by hand, a mishmash of stuff over the years. And then they've got this nice, fresh new world on the other side where they packaged applications properly, and they'd rather perhaps the happy user's dismay, rebuild to onboard them. I know that there's many ways to do this, but what should you do if you're faced with that balance of needs?
You literally made me laugh because you gave a really good use case in that there actually go to Intune. So thanks for that.
it's a use case, but then they don't want to, we don't want to onboard them because we don't trust those old machines,
100%. So there's different ways to obviously do the onboarding. I think you had Quest in your last episode, who've got the on-demand manager, which I made reference to in the article, which you do the works the on-prem domain join PCs up to enter ID, which I said I think is a good use case, especially if you're like acquiring a company, you're doing a merger, etc. It's a great use case, but unfortunately, the first time I probably say it in public, it's a really good time to actually go to a hybrid enter ID join if you've got existing devices only. Not if you've got brand new devices and you want it to enroll them. If you've got brand new devices and From that point onwards, when you get Intune installed on a call to config on there, go enter ID joins. It's best practice for Microsoft. Microsoft recommend that autopilot devices go to enter ID and not hybrid enter ID join, because you need line of sight of domain controller. And it is a faff to set up, and actually puts the whole point of, you know, device to a user's desk and load it and it to be ready in 30 minutes out the window. Got a hybrid method. You can start, if you're using something like Config Manager, it's a good chance that time there to go co-managed. Work out what type of applications you've got in Config Manager and start to do that migration across when it comes to applications. There's a great tool out there called Remo3. Not sure if you come across them, but it does a whole inventory of everything within your Config Manager and actually does that that migration up to Intune for you. And that's literally such a good tool, the best on the market for that use case of finding out, you know, and I think if endpoint admins at the moment probably listen to this and laugh, but Config Manager's probably got 1,000 different applications. Most of these admins have probably got thousands of applications within Config Manager and probably only using like 10, 15 of them. There's loads, which could be scripts, it could be old updates, old policies that are all part of his applications. Remo3 can actually, and I'm not paid from Remo3 to say this at all, it's not an advertisement, but it's a really good tool. It's just a really good tool to use in situation. And you've got the whole wipe a device and put it back up. But for me, that's a bit extreme, especially for legacy devices to wipe a device and then put it straight into Enter ID. The journey doesn't have to be fight like 2 months, 3 months, 6 months. It could, like, the journey to Intune could be, you know, the device life cycle.
So I suppose the key, don't set or don't suggest to management unrealistic timescales. Like we'll do it in 3 months, when actually you end up planning to co-manage for 6 months or a year or longer. But 100%. There's tools on the market out there that make it easy to repackage applications. But the Win32 packaging is really, you know, straightforward as well, right? You know, it's
another practical 365 article that's done very well that I wrote was the .exe application repackage. So that's out now. You've got the new store, which was released almost a year now, so not too old. And they've also just released last month the it's called Enterprise Application Management as well within the Intune suite. Does a similar job to a third-party product called Patchbind PC, which actually does management of those applications to devices. So when the application goes out of date, Microsoft goes through, does the repackaging and updates the applications on the device as well and within Intune.
Oh, yeah. Back in the day, I suppose, whichever day that was, I think there was a product called Shavlik that did something similar, and it had lists of applications that it could package and patch. But one of the most miserable experiences of my life has always been application packaging. And with the Win32 packaging and then the Intune configuration, I actually quite enjoyed it. I wanted to package everything.
Yeah,
I even package Winget scripts.
Yeah, whether for my own machine or not.
Yeah, I packaged my NVIDIA drive. I was packaging the whole lot. I was like, seeing how quick. I even said to one of our airport people, I said, "I bet by the time it takes you to explain this, I'll have packaged something." Then I shut up and realized I went a little bit too far with thinking I was an expert packager, and I should just stick to delivering parcels of joy in the form of podcasts instead. But it's, you know, it is a very, very impressive. So it's, things in Intune are still a bit all over the place, though, you know. Though I, you know, it's, if you want to do configuration in one place and then you've got security policies in another place and conditional access in another place, things that lead you down towards different avenues to accomplish what you might have done on premises, you know, that can be off-putting, because it can, if you start fishing around for where the features are, you soon have to go back and read the manual, right? You know, is there a good way of being able to translate your knowledge across to know where to set firewall policies versus enabling or changing services?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the big problems I kind of see with Intune as well, is that you go onto the endpoint security tab, you've got firewalls and ASR, attack surface reduction, and you can actually do that in two different places. Like the disk encryption can be done in three different places. And, you know, if you were to do that in three different locations and they all conflict, issues there. I kind of say just speak to an expert. Don't just do it on your own environment without actually with no prior experience. Figure out exactly what you want it to look like, your environment, and start working out. I always like to do things in that endpoint security tab first, and then build out from the back of that, because I think there's a lot more granularity when it comes to the settings in there. One thing I would say advise against is those baselines at the moment. They're very out of date, very, very out of date. And we should start looking at, you know, sys policies and other policies out there. Another community one, Open Intune Baselines, is really good if you want to start looking at endpoint security policies. But
if this is your vendor, though, then, you know, that's certainly something that I suppose if you're going to Intune sessions at the MVP summit, maybe you can bring this up. Even if you can't report back, but it's a sound a little bit.
I've already reported this. This is something may hopefully be resolved one day.
In terms of how you go about this, there's ways of doing this in terms of making sure you don't end up with overlapping policies, but it can get a little bit complex. But if you were coming from another product or you're coming from Config Manager, then that was already really complicated anyway. So it's just that the translation is not, you know, immediate when you go across, but it's worth the journey, you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's a different way to skin a cat with that. You can do group policies with stuff on premise, and do something else in Config Manager, then do a script with registry stuff. Like, you know, there's loads of different ways to. That's a really extreme example, obviously, but yeah, it's different.
So when you're onboarding these machines, then I think this is my last question. Are there things that are worth taking advantage of? For example, if you're bringing machines across and you know that they need particular things, or there's certain stuff that you're expecting to be a problem, such as, let's say, the potential that people have not just admin permissions, but they've been given additional rights and things like that. One way of going about that might be to have a great script that can go and do these things and do them in a programmatic way and fail back. Other ways might be by policies. So if you're looking at that sort of option to try and onboard the machines, you know, as you recommend, but then bring them to a good state, there's scripts that you can run from Intune. There's obviously the packages and the configuration policies. There's the compliance policies, but there's also these remediation
tasks. Scripts,
and these remediation scripts that can run on a regular basis seem, you know, an interesting way of approaching that as well. How do you go about picking the right way to, or how do you remediate the existing machine safely? Because I know some folk are worried about running scripts on these, you know, on their existing estate that haven't been running regularly, you know, already.
So keep it basic. When you go into Intune from that sense, keep it really basic. There's obviously going to be a load of group policies that have been running on premise that may have some conflicting settings for Intune. So keep it really basic when you go up first. You know, do a proof of concept, get a bunch of devices up there and see what the behavior is, first of all, if the behavior is good. Also, at that point, the group policy script report that you can do within Intune, run that. Go through all the group policies that are on those devices, run that, see what is prevalent to Intune. It could be running Intune. Start to look to see if they're actually worth it. Are these group policies here from Windows XP and Windows 7 not really needed anymore? What's a waste of time? What's not? Start building up from that point there. Start looking at conditional access policies at that point. See if they need to, and start to get the security side of that part there up and running at that point. And as you said, the remediation policies and stuff like that, is there anything that, that needs to be taken off of those devices? Is there applications that you might need to be removed and start to filter up that level? So keep it basic at the beginning, bring everything over, start looking at the group policies that are in place, and start looking at your security policies that can go into Intune to give extra functionality. So Windows Hello for Business, make sure that's and get that set up. Make sure that, disk encryption, so BitLocker, get that, make sure that's set up if it's not already, and start doing if that is, and then work from there, to be honest. That would be my basic what to start with, to be honest.
Now, it sounds like out the back of that, there's some more articles you need to write, John, because I've got only more questions. Because I'm like, okay, so, one of those will be around assessing group policies, and you've hinted on basically the right place to start, but that's obviously a common challenge. I don't know what policies apply to all my machines, and even if you've got a list of them, or what do you do with them then? How do you pick them all? So there's certainly some follow-ups that I'd be interested to learn about.
So what I always say, especially with the group policy bit, is try to forget everything you've done in the past when you go to Intune.
Try.
And start fresh.
Some of us have no choice.
Forget everything that everything in the past when it comes to group policies, because 9 times out of 10, they're not needed. Group policies that I've seen in the past and worked with in the past, are device restriction policies that are there in Intune already. As I said, don't really look at the security baselines at the moment. There's loads of good ones with SIS and community ones to get your device up to like SIS standards.
Yeah.
Those SIS standards that are on premise on your group policy don't actually cater for a Intune join device. So you got to start again. You have to start again.
So policies that are aimed at securing devices, start again, do it the modern way. But if you're looking at policies for Edge to set or enforce settings, home pages, default search, all that, those sort of things, the configuration of the machine and the way it looks and feels, then that's where those policies that might have been Office ADMX templates.
Exactly, That look and feel stuff. Yeah. Feel free to migrate it, because no one wants to start that fresh. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you try to do an XML layout and stuff like that, but it's fiddly work. If it's already there working, migrate that across. It is there now. Yeah. You can actually import ADMX templates and stuff into Intune now. If it's not already there, setting's not already there, so you can migrate stuff across now. It's not particularly hard to do that nowadays. It was a couple of years back, but they made it really easy to do now. But look and feel stuff, general, what does a user see every day? Yeah, move it across. But your security stuff, start again.
Yeah. And I suppose that's why we're thinking about this. And we said earlier, things are all in different places. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? If you're looking at basic config of the machine, apart from security, and there's better ways of doing it somewhere else. That's why you start in, as you said, start with the security, build up from there. That's some really good advice. I feel like I've learned a bit, having tried to gin up and bring my knowledge up to date on Intune myself over the last few weeks. And now I feel like I should have spoke to you first. because I definitely just playing around in the portal. I started there, then soon realised I needed to read the manual because things had moved so much, in 18 months or so.
Well, maybe we have a lot more opportunities to talk soon.
You don't want me asking you. Ask you, Chris. I'm actually not that bad. I must admit. But thank you so much for joining us on the show, John. It was a pleasure to speak to you.
Yes, I'm delighted you were able to come, John.
Anytime. I think, Paul, last time I saw you was in Southampton, the South Coast Summit, I believe.
Probably so. I'm kind of waiting to see what the Q4 event schedule looks like. Microsoft has announced dates for Ignite in Chicago. Mm-hmm. I haven't been tracking what everybody else is doing, so you may see me in Southampton again this year.
Dallas, the experts conference in the Is it first October?
Yep, 1st and 2nd October. I will absolutely be speaking at that. So if you're going to be there, I'll see you there.
Fingers crossed. Fingers crossed.
Right on.
The way it's going, it might be an interesting session then. But from the sound of it, it could be one of many things, to be fair. The multi-talented John with us on the show today. Thank you so much again for joining us. I think with that, Paul, that's all we've got time for the show today.
I think that it is. That wraps up episode 15. So don't forget to subscribe to the Practical 365 podcast at practical365.com or wherever you get your good podcast from. I'm packing a bag and I'm off to the summit. So thanks for listening.